Hello, and welcome to the Clinical Care Options Oncology Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Quill. This episode features a conversation between a transgender individual and an oncologist on navigating the healthcare system. It is part of a larger educational program titled Multidisciplinary Approach to Ensure Inclusive, Compassionate, and High-Quality Healthcare for Transgender Individuals. During this podcast, activist and filmmaker Yi Wang Chong will share his experiences as a transmasculine breast cancer survivor with Dr. Norma Steiner, a gynecologic oncologist from Permanente Medicine in Portland, Oregon, and Rachel Andre, a scientific director here at Clinical Care Options. Discussion topics include a framework for supporting the emotional, social, medical, and legal aspects of transgender care, getting language right and how to gracefully recover from fumbles, sensitively and accurately approaching ongoing cancer care in transmasculine and transfeminine individuals, handling billing and charting challenges when caring for a transgender patient, and ideas for institutional change to improve healthcare for transgender individuals. For more information on Yi Wan and Dr. Steiner, along with a link to the complete program, please visit the show notes for this episode. Now let's get started and hear what they have to say.
Hello and welcome. My name is Rachel Andre and I'm a scientific director at Clinical Care Options. And I am leading the development of a comprehensive continuing professional development program on transgender healthcare, including the podcast you're listening to today. I'm honored to be in conversation with Yi Wan Chong, consultant and strategist for social justice and equality, and one of the filmmakers of the documentary Trans Dudes with Lady Cancer, and Dr. Norma Steiner, a gynecologic oncologist at Permanente Medicine in Portland, Oregon, who I will ask to share a little bit about themselves and how they came to be talking with me today about transgender healthcare. Yi Wan?
Hi, everyone. My name is Yi Wan Chong, and I am a cancer survivor, and I identify as transmasculine. I had stage 2 breast cancer and went through chemotherapy, radiation, and several surgeries, which brings me to the documentary, Trans Dudes with Lady Cancer, that basically talks about the journey that I went through and also my co-filmmaker, Brooks Nelson, went through. We were diagnosed with cancer around the same time and we live under the same roof. And so we kind of at some point look at each other and figure, given our background as activists, as people who use film and storytelling as a way to try to make the world better, we decided that we would make a film about this. So that's a little bit about me.
Great. Hi, I'm Dr. Norma Steiner. I am a Western-trained gynecological oncologist. And when I graduated medical school 20-some-odd years ago, transgender care was not part of the curriculum. And I had had the pleasure of meeting Yuan through his housemate, Brooks, who, as you just heard, is a patient of mine. They asked if I could be in their film. And at the time, I had very, very limited experience with transgender care. And I think I probably represent the majority of the medical community at that time. But being part of this experience, it really became interwoven into my story. Seeing what their experience was like in healthcare really stuck with me. And I couldn't unsee it. And so I realized that I am in a position within the medical community to make a difference in the evolution of care for the transgender community.
Well, thank you both so much for being here today. I really look forward to our conversation. I just want to add a little bit about myself. I am also a young adult cancer survivor. I had stage 2 breast cancer and went through all the things Yuan mentioned, the radiation, surgeries, chemotherapy, and also post anti-recurrence therapy for about 10 years. I also identify as queer. And it was my involvement in these two communities, the AYA cancer community and the LGBTQ plus community, that landed me at the premiere of Yi Wan's documentary. So I was there for the first showing of Trans Dudes with Lady Cancer at the Clinton Street Theater back in November 2018. And now here we are talking and we're going to get to learn from Yi Wan and Norma. So Yi Wan, you're our leading expert here. And, you know, I very much relate to your story around being a young breast cancer survivor, which was hard enough without the added challenge of navigating what I imagined to be an uninformed healthcare system as a transgender individual. So to set the stage, can you share a bit more about what you've learned about transgender healthcare through your experience being treated for cancer, along with now, you know, being an activist in the setting?
Yeah. So one of the ways that I help people to think about transgender people and healthcare, and actually this is a framework that works for many different things, is to think about it as being four different aspects that you have to consider. And at the heart of it is the emotional aspect that someone would need to, you know, just go through. Certainly, you know, being transgender in our society is not an easy thing, and it can be a lot of emotional burden. Then the other aspects are social, medical, and legal, and I'll go through what I mean by them individually. And so what I mean by social, the social aspect to for transgender healthcare practitioners to think about is the part where you're relating to someone very socially. And this is the part where you start to get to know someone, you build trust, you might build some intimacy. All the social parts are just how you see someone as another human. What is their name? What are the pronouns that they use? And who are they with? What's the relationship between those people? Like just the basic things that you would see to relate to someone. And then the medical part, what in the medical world you might use in terms of anatomy, what are the treatments based on someone's assigned sex at birth, all those things that are related to them medically. And then the last piece, legal, has to do with the different things that someone needs in terms of documentation. What is their sex that is on their legal documentation? So what we call gender marker, what's their gender marker in documentation, in the records that your clinic or hospital might keep about this person? And then related to that, it would be insurance and maybe even research and trials. How are these things documented from a legal aspect? So I generally use this framework to help people really understand the different areas that they have to consider when thinking about someone who's transgender and what they have to go through.
Thank you so much, Yuan. I appreciate your insights. And I just want to let our listeners know that we're going to use this as a framework in the conversation we're going to have today. So we're going to jump into some emotional, which, you know, crosses over to social. And really, you know, all of these are interrelated. So it's going to be a spectrum. But let me start out by asking you, Yuan, what is your biggest fear when you go into an appointment with a new healthcare provider? What were you feeling when you went to your first oncology appointment?
Yeah, I think for me is to know whether my healthcare practitioner understand the unique circumstances that I might go through as a transgender person, whether they are open and accepting, and they don't have to know everything, just as long as they are open-minded to knowing and learning on your own really helps for me. I was lucky to have a primary care physician that did some of the legwork for me. When I went to see my oncologist, sometimes I have conversation with people who do that work themselves or have to do that work themselves. And often the answer that they might get is that, you know, calling a clinic and asking, have you ever seen someone who's transgender? Sometimes the answer that they get is that we are welcoming of everyone and, you know, we treat everyone the same. I particularly don't find that helpful. It doesn't tell me much when I hear that answer. And I would appreciate more about being more specific and even saying that, hey, maybe, you know, we have never seen someone transgender before, but we are learning and we might stumble, but we are open to learning more.
How about you, Norma? How was your experience? What was it like seeing your first transgender patient?
It was really a lesson in humility. I had this vision of myself as being you know, pretty open-minded and even keeled, I would even say. Not much surprises me. And in surgery, I'm known for trying to remain calm when facing uncertainty. So, right, I had this idea that, oh, this experience, even though it's new, I'm pretty sure I can handle it. But actually what happened was that when I first got in there, I was so nervous. I mean, I was trying to use all the right words. I started sweating, which I actually felt like, okay, this is not going all that well. And what it felt like was, as I was trying to string words together really cautiously, it felt like I just swallowed a mouthful of marbles. It just wasn't me. I was so tongue-tied. And so I felt like I stumbled on the vocabulary first, and I could see my medical assistant just shot me a look like, oh my goodness, what is happening to you? You know, it was such a look of surprise. I could see that in the mirror that she was giving me. And so I was fumbling and so far off from that vision I set for myself. You know, so looking back, I really just have to laugh. I don't know how I thought it was going to go, but it certainly was supposed to be a lot smoother than it was. And I think I learned a lot along the way.
So you say you've learned a lot along the way. You know, what are some of the highlights that you've learned, and where have you come? How does it feel now?
I think looking back, I would have been a lot more natural. Certainly recognizing that it was a new experience for me, instead of trying to fool somebody that, you know, I'm really comfortable with doing this and I do this all the time. I think what's hard is the medical community. We are often looked at for knowing the right answers, or not just knowing it, but just having the right answers. That's why people come to us. At least that's what it's perceived. And so there just is a lot of pressure just to have the expertise on pretty much everything. At least that's what it feels like. So even though it's a new experience, I really had this really high standard that I couldn't get things wrong. And I think that a lot of people do feel that way in our field. So I think through the years, what I recognize is just to be as transparent as possible is probably going to be the thing that builds the most trust, rather than trying to have all the answers, acknowledging when I don't have all the answers or where I'm not as fluent in vocabulary, and asking patients to be more partners in a process where I may not get it right or I don't have that experience, but I'm willing to learn. And I think that's probably where it's a lesson in learning how to be a little bit more vulnerable. It doesn't have the effect that I thought it would. In fact, when I thought in the past that would make me look like I don't have a lot of confidence, but now that I'm more comfortable with it, I actually think that builds confidence. So I don't know, Ewan, how does that resonate with you? Did I get that right? Because I actually never asked anybody. This is just my impression.
Yeah, I would prefer that honesty. And also because there are a lot of nuances in our vocabulary, and also a lot of changes. In the past, we may, like, say, ask someone about their preferred pronoun. And now it's just, what is your pronoun?
Wait, say that again. Am I already irrelevant? I mean, I already studied that for so long just to say that right, just to get that right. And now it's already 6 months past.
Yeah. And also now you might actually hear people say gender pronoun, which I actually try to get people not to say. And one of the reasons is that this is an English language communication issue. We're really talking about what is someone's third person pronoun. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is a tendency to look at when someone say gender pronoun, to make that as a shortcut, as understanding someone's gender identity. Mm-hmm. Through their pronoun. Mm. And there is just so many different type of gender identities. It is such a rich thing that we can't really dwindle it down to specific pronouns like he, she, mm-hmm. they, or Z. Some people might use Z. There's just, yeah, a lot of that frankly, even I don't know all the different terms for gender identity. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, good. You know what? Thank you for saying that, because I have to be honest. I was really trying to get it right so badly, to the point where I was so dizzy trying to figure out the pronouns and making sure I was getting it right before my office visit, that I actually had a confusion of what to call myself. You know, I didn't even understand, like, okay, am I a female? But is that, no. Okay. I'm not trans. Okay, fine. Then what's the opposite? Okay, am I cis? Do I say, oh, I'm a cis female? I mean, honestly, I had such a hard time even trying to figure out how to introduce myself. Like, that's how dizzying the pronoun situation really got me. And I do think that that's something that is intimidating for somebody that's not in this world. And I'm apparently for someone that's in the world, so that I appreciate just telling me that also is confusing for you too. And so I think for our audience, you just said something so important. You know, I'm already outdated in the way I describe it. And I think what we have to understand with what we're doing is we're in evolution. And what we say today is going to continuously evolve so that maybe it is going to be a completely different word that's not even invented yet that will describe the person in front of you. So I think that's what it is the ability to know that you may not get it right and just to continuously learn and evolve and just understanding that there's a little bit of compassion for not having all those right answers right away.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, this goes back to the social part. The introduction for me is really important. And what I mean by mm-hmm. that is that entering the space, mm-hmm. The healthcare practitioner space, whether it's a clinic, it's a hospital, that's a introduction to me of like, what is this space? How am I receiving messages about how open this space will be or how welcoming this space would be? And then going into the examination room and the first interaction that I might have, like we won't jump into what is your gender identity. We will jump into what is your name and your pronoun. And even in that first interaction, you may not need to know my gender identity, but it would be helpful to know when we are communicating. How do we communicate with each other? Because I might bring someone else with me, and there are certain situations where you will need to use my third person pronoun with the person that I came with mm-hmm. or with the person that helps you in the examination room. And the social aspect has a lot to do with communication and the English language. And I keep saying the English language because even I don't have everything down sometimes. For me, I stumble around pronouns because I grew up with two languages that don't have third person pronoun that are gendered. So there's a third person pronoun that's dia is in Bahasa Malaysia. I'm also ethnically Chinese, and ta is the third person pronoun that is not gender specific. Sometimes speaking in English, I can also get very mixed up because of my background. Mm-hmm. So aside from the language evolving, there might be cultural differences. Mm-hmm. And also, like, what do you need to know when you first meet someone? Mm-hmm. All you need to know is how to address them in a way that's respectful. So is it their name in their legal document, like a driver's license, or is it a name that they use for themselves? Right, you don't want to be using someone's what we call dead naming someone in that situation. Those are like really quick indications for me that this might not be a welcoming environment if they're not paying attention to those things.
Juan, for our listeners, can you please define dead name?
Dead naming is when someone transition and they have a name now that they use for themselves, but their legal documents may not reflect the name that they use now. Changing those documents are not easy at all. And there's so many different documents that you have to change. And sometimes they are cost prohibitive. So in terms of the social aspect, it's really important to respect the name that someone is using for themselves now and not something that is in their legal document.
Right. Thank you for that.
For our audience, how would you recommend recovering after somebody does fumble with language?
So I would say apologizing and do it sincerely. You don't need to provide a long explanation or give any kind of rationalization, or don't even say, I promise not to do that again. You are human. And being human, you're going to fumble again and you're not going to be perfect. You just cannot guarantee that you will not do it again. Saying that you promised is not realistic. So I would say just apologize and try your best. Try your best and maybe even say that I really am sorry that I used the wrong pronoun and I'll try my best. Saying that you try your best is very different from saying that you promise that you won't happen again. So yeah. I would just say, yeah, apologize and do it really, really sincerely.
Mm-hmm. Yuan, I actually wonder how this may land because I agree. The first thing I heard of when you just were talking is that people do feel really uncomfortable just that they got it wrong. So they're flustered. And I think the big thing what you're trying to say is it's okay. Apologize, move on. Don't make it about you. Right. I mean, I think that's what sort of happens. At least for me, I could see myself blundering even further to try to get it right. But I almost would go a step further. Would it be okay then even just to say, oh, I'm sorry, I got that one wrong and I may get that wrong in the future. Would you mind correcting me so that I can continue to learn and practice to get it right?
Yeah, I think that's pretty acceptable. How much do you keep trying on your own and how much do you have someone else educate you? And in this situation, you're not necessarily saying that someone to educate you, right? But it more around like, yeah, I will fumble again. And mm-hmm. and please, you know, raise that so that I can pay attention to it.
That's right.
Thank you both so much for being vulnerable and sharing these experiences with us. I want to move a little bit more into the medical realm. But Yuan, I want to ask you a question. Considering the long-term relationship cancer survivors end up needing to form with our oncology care team, what can you tell us about your experience as a transgender person with ongoing care for a lady cancer? So we've both had breast cancer. I, at the beginning of my care journey, was getting imaging or seeing a doctor every 3 to 6 months. There were yearly mammograms, bi-yearly breast MRIs, breast exams. And then for 10 years, there was surveillance pelvic exams. A lot of the anti-recurrence drugs, the one I was on is called tamoxifen, incur risk for other cancers, in this case, endometrial cancer. So what advice would you have for the oncology care team on how to sensitively approach a trans masculine person that has to go through this type of care?
Yeah, I think language is so important. And that there are some medical terms or even looking at screening, and those terms might not be gendered, right? And sometimes these things are not as gendered. So, for example, having breast exams, right? And instead of saying that, saying chest exam. So I think language can matter quite a bit.
I'm curious, Norm, have you run into non-gendered language for anatomy? Are there other examples other than what Yuan said about using chest for breast?
Yes. Thank you, Yuan. That is so helpful because, again, I'm learning. I'm learning even through the podcast today to de-genderize anatomy. In other words, I think when we talk about body parts that people no longer identify with, it just doesn't really feel right. So let's just for say I'm a gynecological oncologist. And part of my job, what Rachel was just talking about, is I'm the person that has to do these pelvic exams. And one of the things that I'm learning is how to de-genderize anatomy. In other words, so that I'm not saying the words vagina or vulva or something like that. So instead, using the words, oh, okay, I'm going to use a speculum to look inside the canal or the tube. If I said that, Yuan, how does that land with you?
That is, to me, exactly what we're aiming for, degenderize the language.
Yeah. And I think for the audience, there's no accepted way of being able to say that. We're making it up as we go along, as long as the patient knows what we're talking about. So that it's clear what we're going to do. I think the other thing too is really taking the time to pause before the exam and explaining beforehand the process. So there's just no surprises. I think we just have to do this with every patient, but even more so in this situation where, again, people are not identifying with the body parts that have to be examined. So that's my take, is just knowing that some way of communicating in a degenderized way is probably the goal that you'll want to have in your head.
So one other thing about looking at the medical aspect of relating to someone who's transgender or gender nonconforming is not being afraid to touch someone's body, a trans body. Norma, as you have mentioned earlier, there is some discomfort in the social aspect. I do think that there are some discomfort that some practitioners have around the medical aspect in terms of examining someone. And maybe they don't know what parts this person have, especially after they go through cancer. And we can't just make the assumption by looking at someone, oh, this person may not have this particular part or that particular part. I think it's helpful to really keep track of that and read the notes carefully, especially when you're seeing someone for the first time, and to understand specifically what kind of screening that they might need ongoingly and what parts may not need screening anymore. Or maybe they just feel some discomfort because this is just not someone that they typically see. And sometimes it might feel uncomfortable because you're like, well, okay, this person is trans, masculine presenting. So should I examine this thing? Would it be, you know, this part? Would it be disrespectful? Well, yes, everybody's going to be uncomfortable, including the patient. But if you don't, we could be talking about someone's life. It might be a life and death issue if you don't examine that person's body. I think it is really important. And one of our goals for the film is for trans people to advocate for themselves. And if they have the part, get it examined. Right. And so I think it is the same thing, too, if for a physician to know, they just have to get over that discomfort.
Right. And so I think what you're saying is that we have to find a way, even though it's uncomfortable, to approach that. And maybe one of the conversations could be, when I'm hearing your story, I am thinking that it would be important to examine blank, whatever that blank body part is, right? Because one of the things that I want to make sure is that your pain is not coming from blank. Would it be okay if I do that? So I think having just that conversation about why you're wanting to examine and then asking permission is how I would approach it. So I guess I'm asking you, would that be a reasonable way to approach that?
Very much so. The story I often tell is that my doctor examined my chest and did a routine test. Every year I go see her and she gives me an exam. And that year I felt fine. I had no symptoms. And she found something. And it was so hard to find that when I went to see my oncologist, he actually had a hard time finding the tumor and had to ask me to help him to find it. It was already stage two. And if she had not examined it, years could go by and I could start to like show symptoms and could be in a more advanced stage. So I think it's important to tell that story of how that short exam, right? It took her, I don't know, a minute or two. I often talk about how my doctor saved my life. Even at stage two, I went through all those treatments and here I am now, I survived. But we can't really necessarily say if it was a more advanced stage, who knows whether I'll be here today.
Well, we certainly are glad that you are.
It's actually a common refrain in the AYA community that because they're young, people assume they don't have cancer and they end up at advanced stages because maybe they skipped an exam or someone didn't take something seriously. So I could just see that kind of double down if you were a transgender nonconforming individual.
I guess what I'm hearing from both of you for the audience too is really just recognizing that even though people are not in the usual categories is just to continue having that as top of mind of performing exams when it really may be necessary. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Yuan, did you want to talk about the research data?
I can talk a little bit about the medical part that then transitioned us to legal.
Okay, that would be great.
So my experience has been that a lot of times my doctors don't quite know what to tell me in terms of questions around side effects or how taking testosterone might impact me, because there's just a lack of data out there. And a big part of this is that even in the cancer registry, tracking of gender is done in a way where it's not easy for the doctors to indicate someone's assigned sex versus their gender. And so there's just a lack of research and a lack of data, because keeping track of the difference between assigned sex and gender just hasn't been something that has been collected for many years. I think that we are starting to see that a bit more, but it is kind of a new area.
So, Yvonne, we're in this legal aspect of transgender healthcare. I'm wondering how your experience with insurance has been.
Well, I actually have a pretty fascinating story to tell about this. When I first got diagnosed and went through the services that I needed, my gender marker with the hospital was M. And so when I went to the hospital to get an MRI and all of that, the practitioners would use a he pronoun with me, which was fine. But at one point, I needed a transvaginal ultrasound. And this is where things started to, in my documentation, appeared as female. So either the hospital or the insurance changed my gender marker. I wasn't informed. And I assumed that it was because I needed a transvaginal ultrasound that it got changed. So after getting that screening, I went through a surgery. And when I checked into the hospital for this surgery, the people at the front desk now see my gender marker as F. So keep referring to me as she. And I had two other people with me. Brooks was one of them. And then Andre was the other person, another family member. At this point, I'm checking in. I'm trying to get ready for surgery, right? I'm in no place emotionally to talk to the person at the front desk. Brooks then accompanied me into the pre-surgical room. You're probably familiar that that room is pretty small, and they usually limit only bringing one person into the room. And so while I was getting ready for the surgery, and Brooks was with me, about 20 minutes later, that room was filled with people. There must have been like six other people in there at one point. And we found out that Andre had, at the waiting room, had gone back to the check-in people and had talked to them that they used the wrong pronoun with me. And so they came in with a lot of good intention of figuring out what do they do, right? Do they change my gender marker in their records? And we told them, no, don't change it, because I'm about to go through some surgery that the healthcare system see this as a female-related surgery. And if we were to change my gender marker to M, because M and F were the only options that this hospital was using, there might be a chance that the insurance will not cover it. And so we had to tell them, don't change it. All we wanted you to know is that I use he and him pronouns.
Right.
This is, I think, a classic example of where the social aspect, the medical aspect, the legal aspect came together and were inconsistent. And that it is important to know that socially, I wanted people to refer me by using the he pronoun, but then medically, I'm going through something that is specific to my sex assigned at birth, and that in terms of gender, I am transgender. That is a story that I think really highlights why it is important to understand someone using this framework of differentiating medical, legal, social and also the emotional aspect that someone is going through while they are interacting with the healthcare institution.
And I'm sorry that you had to go through that. And I think looking back about how that could have gone smoother for you as someone that provides care, I would just encourage us, the medical community, if we do see inconsistencies, is just to really just pause and ask good questions. You know, maybe that's just a time instead of just going through the motions. And I get it. We are all so busy sometimes. So sometimes we may not think about that, but maybe after this podcast, people will. But if there's inconsistencies, just a simple question of, oh, okay. If someone is appearing male in front of you and having the gender box of a female and undergoing female surgery, just even just pausing and just say, oh, got it. Okay. How would you like to be called? You know, maybe that would have just helped to alleviate a lot of that tension before undergoing a surgery, which I'm sure is also scary for anybody. That's what I would encourage. Right now, we're behind as far as the check boxes and billing and everything like that. Yuan, you are right. There just wasn't any way to really capture what was happening to the person that it was happening to from a billing standpoint. I actually work for an organization that I don't personally really have to bill, but I do find that even as simple as the exam type, there's this exam type that you're supposed to check for what they call a well woman exam. And that is probably not at all what you would identify with. So what do you check for that box? So I think in time, hopefully legislation or the terminology will change to catch up, to properly reflect and be consistent with providing care to the person that we're providing it to. So that's my hope.
Yeah, I think this is such a great point, Norma. I think this is where I would say that individuals, as much as they can try and be culturally competent, if the institution is not there to support them, that person will continue to have to navigate a lot of complication and maybe even come across situations where their support for that person is just so limited. So one of the things I would say to this audience is that wherever you can see an opportunity to have this conversation with the institution, you will actually make a longer lasting and more widespread change that can make trans persons' experience much more positive.
I agree. And it'll be smoother for everybody involved. I think in the last couple of years, I noticed that in our electronic medical record system, we actually now we have pictures, which we didn't have 10 years ago, so that we can see what the person looks like. So that gives us a first clue of when we open the chart and review everything that we know who we're dealing with. But then also now we have underneath that picture, the pronoun and what they like to be called. So I think that in and of itself went a long, long way. And I don't know if everybody works in that same situation that they have that, but I certainly feel like technology gave me just a little clue so that I can tailor my interactions to be more, again, consistent. So you're right. Just every little thing counts. I also want to say that I just recently had to have a conversation about making institutional change, just little steps, because I don't think this is all new territory, new frontier. So just the background of the story is that it wasn't easy for someone to obtain a mammogram who needs a mammogram because they had undergone top surgery. So the front desk, which is a receptionist at the radiology department, kept saying, no, you don't need that. Meanwhile, this person is a mutation carrier, meaning that they have a predisposition to having breast cancer and needs not only a mammogram, but a mammogram and MRI, you know, and twice a year. So it had become increasingly frustrating for the person to obtain that from the radiology department just because they kept denying that that was even necessary. So it took a call to the radiologist to say, listen, this is what's happening in the department, and I can't understand why this is happening, but I have a feeling it really just takes conversation with your staff. And certainly that is what just happened. They just had an in-service to say, oh, actually, this is indicated. And what I think in the future for institutions is that you will see things that maybe, again, isn't consistent with what you normally see. And maybe what has to happen is that there is a written comment in an ordering section of a lab or radiology order that calls attention to ask your supervisor or ask somebody, because it doesn't seem like this person needs it. I think that's the next thing that has to happen. It's some sort of terminology that says, okay, look, it may not make sense, but it actually is the right thing. So this person in front of you, they don't feel like they have to constantly be arguing that they need a test or an imaging that is required.
Yeah, this is actually a good segue into the curbside effect thing that I want to bring up. Even though our conversation right now is focusing on improving transgender healthcare, I also think that this is a great opportunity to look at it as not just transgender, but gender. And what I mean by that is that in our society, we look at gender in a very rigid way. And transgender rights, or however you want to call it now, like there's much more awareness and exposure and conversation about transgender people in community. It actually is a conversation about gender, and every single person has a gender. And that the rigidity of how we look at gender is the problem here. And so I think in the healthcare sector, if we start to look at this topic, we can actually not just improve experience and health of transgender people, we can also improve how women, cisgender women experience and how everyone experience healthcare. So an example is in one of the screenings that we've done with our film, there was a cisgender woman who shared her story that she has the mutation as well. And wanted a double mastectomy, but without reconstruction. And all the doctors that she went to, plastic surgeons, you know, not just one, a couple, really said things that wasn't very supportive, and basically saying that she's making a mistake. Mm-hmm. It is her choice. Yeah. And wanting a double mastectomy without reconstruction is her choice. And also, it doesn't define her womanhood. In our society where we look at gender in a very rigid way, we associate that somehow to someone's identity of being a cisgender woman. So I think for us to look at this moment, this transgender moment, as not just for transgender people, if we can do really well for that, it will actually also improve many other people's experiences as well.
I 100% agree. I think improving transgender care, it embodies the basic concept of improving care for humans and perhaps what future humans may need. Because we don't know what that's going to look like, but we understand that we're not just checkboxes. It's about personalization. So I 100% agree.
Yeah. And in that personalization, like going back to the point you made, is that why don't we have in the patient's record like an inventory of what parts they have, what needs to get screened on a regular basis, and not use gender as a shortcut to thinking, oh, this person is this gender and therefore they need this screening.
Right. Or they have these parts, right? Because that's exactly right. It can be a whole combination of things. So you're right. We'll have to look at that differently. Mm.
Well, thank you. That was so excellent. I'd like to close with one last question for you both. And that question is, if you had a magic wand, what would you do to improve healthcare for transgender individuals?
Well, for me, how I would use the magic wand is to have this topic be included in medical school on day one. It should not be an elective. It should not be optional. It should be part of the core curriculum.
Yeah, for me, I think that we just have an opportunity to do this much better. I don't think it costs a lot at all. So in other words, I think that it is a really easy win to create a better experience for transgender people. And then map it out. Map it out from the second that a person reaches the building and they encounter the check-in person. What do we want to make sure that experiences like. And then when they go to their physician, and then after that, maybe lab or imaging, all of that. I think that having a experience that suggests that we are all on the same team trying to really provide the best care possible to the person that we're providing it to, it doesn't cost a lot to really just be able to make sure that we are addressing the people that are most comfortable being addressed. So I think that's really what I wish, is that consistency is in the experience.
Yeah, definitely. Because what you experience in the waiting room is going to follow you in the exam room, going to follow you to the lab. So any glitch along that chain is, you know, affects the whole experience.
That's right.
Well, with that food for thought, I'd like to thank you both, Yuan and Norma, for sharing your stories with us and our listeners. We very much appreciate your insights and your time.
Thank you. It has been such an honor to be part of this conversation with both of you.
Same here. Yeah, thank you so much for inviting me to do this.
And I'll also add that if you ever have the opportunity to see Yuan's documentary, Trans Dudes with Lady Cancers, I highly recommend attending a screening.
Thanks very much to Yi Wang and Dr. Steiner for sharing their stories and for their excellent insights. And thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us. As a reminder, to view the full program, Multidisciplinary Approach to Ensure Inclusive, Compassionate, and High-Quality Healthcare for Transgender Individuals from the Clinical Care Options website, please click on the link in the show notes. As always, thanks for listening.